Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn our meeting over to Mr. Jerry Salaf. Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning. It's a little after 11 a.m. here in Silver Spring, Maryland, the home of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. My name, as you just heard, is Jerry Salaf. I'm a public affairs officer with NOAA's Office of Communications, and I'll be honest with you, this is the first news conference I've ever done under quarantine in a T-shirt and sweatpants with a hurricane passing over my house. So these are interesting times, folks. Thanks for calling in for today's teleconference on the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia zone, better known as the dead zone. We'll have four speakers today who will discuss the recent research proves to measure the dead zone, how its observed size compares to NOAA's forecast in June, and federal and state efforts to reduce the nutrients entering into the Gulf. We'll follow with a question and answer session. As a reminder, the session is for the media only. If you're not with the media, I invite you to stay on and listen, but I ask that you refrain from asking questions during the Q&A session. About 15 minutes ago, we sent out our news release summarizing the findings. If you need a copy, please go to our homepage, www.noaa.gov, that's NOAA.gov. Scroll down to the News and Features section and click on Latest Media Releases. We will have four presenters today in this order. Leading us off will be Dr. Nancy Rabelais, a research professor with Louisiana State University and LUMCON, the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. Dr. Rabelais was the principal investigator for the survey crews. She will be followed by NOAA's David Kidwell, director of the Competitive Research Program with NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science, known as NCOS. David will be followed by Mike Negg, Secretary of Agriculture from the state of Iowa, and Mike will be followed by David Ross, the Assistant Administrator, Office of Water, from the Environmental Protection Agency. Both Mike and David are co-chairs of the Hypoxia Task Force. So now I will give the floor to Dr. Rabelais. Nancy, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I would, first of all, the area of low oxygen was extremely small this year. It was 2,117 square miles, or in my jargon, 5,048 square kilometers. And this is well below the projected estimate, which was about four times higher based on Mississippi nitrogen loads to the Gulf of Mexico. The activity in the Gulf that caused this particularly small size was Hurricane Hanna, which moved across the central Gulf of Mexico, and its leading edge contacted the Louisiana shoreline as it moved from the Delta over and into South Texas. And that generated really high winds and really high waves. And those waves mixed up the water column and brought oxygen to the bottom down to about 65 feet. It didn't affect the offshore areas as much, but it was still mixed. The winds, as the hurricane moved from east to west across the Gulf and along the Louisiana shore, were predominantly from the south. And that pushes water towards the shore and creates what we call downwelling conditions so that the bottom water moves further offshore. So you can see from the map from this year that there's very little low oxygen in the shallower inshore waters, and the dark red orange is in much deeper water than we usually find it. So the map is very different this year. The conditions were very different. The science crew had 5 to 6 foot seas and an occasional 8 footer when they first went out. Eventually it calmed down and they all said, thank goodness, because it's a lot easier to work in calm waters than in really rough waters. The size is the size this year is just above the goal for the hypoxia task force, but the size is directly related to the hurricane or tropical storm as it passed Louisiana and then became a hurricane into South Texas. This contributes to the variability that we see every year. And the goal is a 5-year average to take care of this variability, and the 5-year average is near 14,000 square kilometers right now. So we still have a lot of work to do. I'm glad we got out this year because it gives us another aspect of what the Gulf, how the Gulf is going to respond to these major mixing events. The low oxygen will redevelop as long as the winds stay lower and the water's calm. We're also in a period of low flow for the Mississippi River, so that there's not as much fresher water getting offshore, which would help develop the stratification. But it's also become stratified by thermal heating from the sun in the surface and the lower water column. So those conditions can redevelop anywhere between a couple of days or a week or two, depending on where on the shelf the restratification occurs. Let me see, what else? There are some very sophisticated models that can illustrate the low oxygen on a so-called regular year. But these unusual conditions show how important it is to keep the information coming in from the research cruises on the Pelican, funded by NOAA, and also these models that are being run, also funded by NOAA, need this type of information for their development and calibration of their models. So it's been a good combination of modeling and monitoring that brings the information that we have today. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Next up, David Kidwell from NOAA. David?
Thank you, Jerry, and good morning. As Jerry mentioned, I'm David Kidwell. I'm director of the Competitive Research Program within NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science. And my remarks today will touch on NOAA's role in providing the coastal science focused on hypoxia in the northern Gulf of Mexico that inform activities of the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force, or also known simply as the Hypoxia Task Force. And additional details on the Hypoxia Task Force will be discussed in greater depth by the subsequent speakers, Assistant Administrator Ross and Secretary Negg. NOAA's role is really three-pronged. First, we provide the funding to measure the size and extent of the hypoxic zone. Second, we fund and develop tools, as Dr. Rabelais indicated, to forecast the size of the hypoxic zone relative to a suite of factors that control hypoxia. And third, we fund research to better understand the impacts of hypoxia on living resources. These activities enable managers, the task force, and other partners the ability to make science-based decisions to mitigate the impacts of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. The annual measurement of the hypoxic zone, led by Dr. Rabelais, has occurred since 1985, and it provides a valuable long-term data set. As with the hurricane this year, the results of the cruise can often be impacted by a number of factors, And as Dr. Rabelais mentioned, this is why the task force frequently uses or does use an average over 5 years as a key metric to monitor progress towards its long-term goal of 1,900 square miles. Including the 2020 size, which was the third smallest on record, the five-year average now stands at 5,408 square miles. In addition, the monitoring crew's results provide a valuable means of testing and improving the suite of models and tools that are used to forecast the hypoxic zone and inform nutrient reduction targets. In June of 2020, NOAA provided a forecast for the size of the hypoxic zone. This forecast, issued each year, is generated by a suite of NOAA-run models and are guided by data provided by the U.S. Geological Survey. The forecast for 2020 predicted an above-average hypoxic zone of approximately 6,700 square miles. This was based on high... While these forecast models have a good track record, they do not account for major storms such as Hurricane Hanna. And the difference between the forecast and the measured size provides useful information on the role that Mississippi River discharge and weather patterns have in controlling the severity of hypoxia. As Dr. Rabelais indicated, winds from storms such as Hurricane Hanna can temporarily disrupt the hypoxic zone, but once they have subsided, the hypoxic zone typically takes about a week or so to reform in the summer, assuming the winds have died down. The hypoxic zone does lead to extensive habitat loss for several ecologically and commercially important species in the northern Gulf of Mexico. Fish, shrimp, crabs often swim out of the area, but less mobile animals are stressed or killed by the low oxygen. Research suggests long-term population and food web impacts on mobile species occur as a result. Non-lethal impacts to reproduction and growth, enhanced predation due to displacement from preferred habitat, and longer transit time for fishing vessels to reach harvest locations are only some of the ways the hypoxic zone can impact commercial fisheries. NOAA has ongoing investments to better understand the long-term impacts on living resources and incorporate this information into tools that can connect watershed activities with impacts to coastal ecosystems. And with that, I look forward to any questions that you have and at the conclusion of your opening remarks.
Thank you, David. Next up, we have Mike Nagg from the State of Iowa Secretary of Agriculture. Mike.
Good morning, and nice to be with all of you. I'm happy to be here this morning joining with EPA's Dave Ross as co-chair of the Hypoxia Task Force and on my part, representing the states. And, Dave, I certainly appreciate the ongoing partnership and the commitment that EPA has shown in supporting states by increasing some funding and resources available to us, and also maybe most importantly, the willingness to hear us out, address barriers that are in the way oftentimes in achieving our goals as states. And so we appreciate that ongoing partnership and relationship. So this morning we're talking about NOAA's annual hypoxia zone measurement. And I really just want to stress that this is just one indicator used to gauge our collective efforts to improve water quality throughout the entire Mississippi River Basin. You know, as a co-chair of the Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force, I know that there are leaders from the 12 states that border the Mississippi and Ohio Rivers that are working alongside five federal agencies, including the EPA and USDA and the National Tribal Water Council to help improve water quality locally, but also, of course, we know if we do things right locally, we can impact downstream. You know, I think one thing that the annual measurement shows is that there's significant variability in the size of the zone each year. You know, for example, Gulf of Mexico hypoxia zone was the largest in 2017, and just 1 year later, it was the fourth smallest, and today we're talking about the third smallest. As has been mentioned, there are obviously a number of things that impact the size of the zone, and weather is certainly the most influential. Upstream, we might have not enough water and drought, or we might have too much water. And, of course, the weather impacting the Gulf as well, including hurricanes, can certainly affect the size of the zone. And while the size does fluctuate each year, it does remain an important way to measure success in the region, but it is just one way to measure. You know, each state in the task force is committed and has committed funding and research and resources to implement nutrient reduction strategies that fit their local landscapes. and they're focused on addressing their local needs. But I think we can all recognize that when we effectively manage stormwater and wastewater and we add conservation practices to the landscape upstream, we have a positive impact on our local water bodies, but also ultimately downstream, the size and duration of the hypoxia zone in the Gulf. And as states, we are certainly focused on and working to find the right balance between improving water quality while maintaining, in our case, productive food systems and transportation systems, and essentially and ultimately empowering people to enjoy economic prosperity up and down the river. This process will take time. We're talking about making changes on a continental level, but I'm also confident that we're on the right track as states. So in closing, again, happy to be here this morning, looking forward to the questions, but I would like to acknowledge that each state has success stories that they would be willing to share, and I can't possibly do justice to all of them this morning, so I would just encourage those in the media, if you'd like to learn more about the conservation work that's happening all over the basin, I would encourage you to reach out to my peers and my colleagues on the task force. We're all working hard, we're working together, and we're working to install more conservation practices on our local landscapes, again, because we know that is the way to impact water downstream. So thanks again. Looking forward to answering questions.
Thank you, Mike. And batting cleanup is David Ross from the Office of Water of EPA. David?
Well, hey, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity, and good morning, everybody. I guess batting cleanup, I have the advantage of the hard work has been done, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to join this call, is to express our deep appreciation and thanks to our partners at NOAA and at the Louisiana State University. The annual cruise and more importantly, the modeling and predictive abilities of the agencies to tell us what to expect in the Gulf, and more importantly, how our activities upstream and upriver impact the Gulf. Those are extremely valuable tools. This is really an important data point that we do every year. And so first and foremost, thanks to our friends and colleagues at Louisiana State University and at NOAA. It's really critically important work. As Mike said, and thanks, Mike, for really providing a nice overview of the Hypoxia Task Force and the work the states are doing. And as Mike said, the annual cruise is a critical data point because it tells us how we're doing. The thing that EPA takes out of it and the thing that I personally take out of it is it's a reminder that we have more work to do. And you have to look at this over a five-year rolling average. That's why the Hypoxia Task Force established the framework that it did. Because you can have have high highs and low lows. The number one message is that we still have issues that we have to address and keep an eye on the ball, and that's upstream. We are extremely proud and pleased with the work of the states, the 12 states that Mike mentioned on the main stem and then throughout the basin. Happy to be working with our state partners. As Mike said, this is modification on a subcontinental scale that takes years to see changes in the system. So as you apply land practices out of the landscape, what that means for downstream water quality in addition to local water quality, it takes time. So what is EPA doing? We have four primary tools that help in this space. Our power of funding, our scientific development, our use of law and policy, and then fourth, and maybe most important in this space, is our power to convene. As Mike said, EPA is extremely serious about addressing excess nutrients across the country and also particularly in the Gulf. And so we have upped our game in providing additional funding, but particularly targeted funding over the last couple of years to our 12 state partners with the ask that they continue to work on, update, and modernize their state nutrient reduction strategies. The response by our state partners has been great. We are really pleased with the creativity and how each state is spending the money, and each state is doing it differently, which is the beauty of our country and the system. But the funding that we're providing through grants, the farmer-to-farmer conservation programs, and others with our partners at USDA, funding is important. we're developing science, whether or not it's new cyanobacteria assessment tools or water quality standard, water quality criteria. We've got a proposal out on the street right now for new draft ambient water quality criteria recommendations for nutrients in lakes. I really am happy with the development of the science supporting that document. Looking at stressor response as really a better way to think about how excess nutrients interface with ecology. And so I recommend that people follow that effort closely. It's great new science. We're developing new policies, particularly trying to incentivize water quality trading as a way to bring more money, private equity, into the nutrient reduction space. The power of federal and state governments to fund is important, but we also need private sector involvement as well. And then the power to convene, and the hypoxia task force is a prime example of EPA has co-chaired that for a long time now with our partners at Iowa, and enjoy that relationship. If Mike mentioned that the states are doing a lot of work, we spent a lot of time talking about the annual cruise and how important that is and what the size of the Gulf is. When I took over as co-chair a couple of years ago, the hypoxia task force, I knew the work that the states were doing to address excess nutrients, but I wasn't convinced that the states were as transparent and could do a better job telling the story of the work that they're doing. So EPA has created a new newsletter that we issue every quarter. Our most recent newsletter was out in July 2020. It focuses on providing the public with better access to what the states are doing to address excess nutrients. I strongly encourage people to subscribe to that newsletter and get engaged, take a look at it. Over the last year, we've really highlighted some great work that's happening out in the landscape. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Jerry. Again, thanks for the opportunity to participate today, and look forward to answering any questions that you may have.
Well, great. Thanks to all our participants. And the skies have parted here in Silver Spring. It is sunny, and we will now take specific questions. Please be sure to indicate who you would like to answer the question. Again, as a reminder, this is a call for the media only. And since this is a very unusual year, we're all speaking to you remotely. And I apologize in advance for any confusion or crosstalk during the Q&A. Operator, please remind our reporters how to ask a question.
Thank you. If you are with the media and would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name. Thank you. Just a few moments for questions. And our first question is from Mark Schlesstein with New Orleans Advocate. Your line is open.
Thank you. As we heard, this is a snapshot of what happens in the Gulf with the low oxygen zone. Why is there not yet, or are there plans for some sort of wider effort to measure hypoxia in the coastal zone year-round rather than just this single cruise? How significant is it that these results end up skewing the five-year average? Thank you.
This is Dave Kidwell. I can take a shot at answering that question. So it's a very good question, and thank you for asking that. Obviously, the single snapshot that we take, overall seasonal extent and magnitude of a hypoxic zone are. Obviously, we at NOAA at least are committed to providing the support to maintain this monitoring cruise and envision continuing to do so in the coming years. We're also investing in technologies to try to get at that wider snapshot. there, as I'm sure many of you have heard, there are autonomous vehicles that can be placed out into the water that can take various measurements over a large range and large spatial area throughout the summer, let's say, in this instance, to measure low oxygen. Part of the challenges in the northern Gulf of Mexico has been the type of water body that it is, with the Mississippi River coming in, the fact that the low oxygen area sometimes can be very close to the bottom. And so the technology required to adequately measure that has been a bit of a challenge, but we are investing in those technologies, trying to develop the capacity to have a much broader a window into what the hypoxic would be from a measurement perspective. In addition, we've been working with our partners in academia at a number of institutions to develop tools and models that simulate the hypoxic zone throughout the year. In fact, one of our partners ran one of those models shortly before Dr. Rabelais and her team departed for the cruise that actually fairly closely predicted that the storm was going to disrupt it and that the zone was going to be fairly small. And so what we often try to do with those at the end of the season in the fall is we'll run two of those models to develop a retrospective analysis. And so we'll get some idea of the perhaps the maximum extent of the dead zone was throughout the summer. And using this monitoring cruise, even though it was smaller in this instance and perhaps did not capture the largest size that it might have been, but this data will be helped to use to validate those model runs and to provide us that more seasonal picture of what happened with the hypoxic zone.
Okay. Anyone else want to weigh in on that? If not, let's take the next question. Operator.
Thank you. Our next question is from Henry Fountain with New York Times. Your line is open.
Thanks. Just to follow up on Mark's question, given that the zone can recover and may have, in fact, recovered somewhat, is there any possibility or thought of trying to do some more monitoring this summer, or is that just not possible money-wise or otherwise?
Well, this is Nancy. We'd love to be able to do more monitoring, but as stated by David Kidwell, there is only so much funding, so it would require more funding, and I'll let somebody else answer that part.
But hey, this is Dave Ross. I'm happy to just give a perspective. I'm obviously more funding to help do additional monitoring in the dead zone would be important for the variety. We've got 5 to 6 federal partners that participate on the hypoxia task force in addition to the states. And so we, you know, there's funding on monitoring in the Gulf itself. There's a lot of money that the agencies put into monitoring the fate and transport of excess nutrients as they come down the basin, so that we can understand if you make a landscape scale or a best management practice change on the landscape, you know, in Iowa or Illinois or Indiana, what that might do to both local and downstream water quality. And so we have to spend a lot of money in the fate and transport modeling, and I know NOAA and USGS do that. And then, you know, we also need to invest actual real on-the-ground science and conservation practices to help us solve the problem that we're monitoring as part of this cruise. And so there's actually a huge amount of federal and state investment that goes into this entire picture. And so if we begin to leverage resources one way or the other, you may do a little less fate and transport modeling or a little less on-the-ground conservation practices. And so that's the balance that we all have to grapple with. And which is one of the reasons why we really focus on the 5-year rolling average, so that we're not, you know, swayed one way or the other in the individual season. Our job is to take a look holistically at the overall size of the of the dead zone, and to look for general trends over years to see whether or not the work we're doing up basin is helping. So more funding is always great, but we also, quite frankly, if I have additional funding, I'm equally interested in trying to apply that on the landscape to keep nutrients in place as opposed to getting into the water bodies.
Okay, let's go to our next questioner.
Thank you. Our next question is from Amy Williams with USA Today Network, Florida. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm guessing that given the time that change takes to happen, that COVID had nothing to do with this. But I just wanted to be sure that you don't think that any of this is an impact of changes in agriculture or general human activity.
Anyone want to take that? Because I don't know if that's within the purview, certainly of NOAA.
Well, I guess this is Dave at EPA, and I'm not the scientist on the phone, and that is a science-related question. But at a high level, the way the system operates and the way the scientists have described it to me is there are significant lag times in the system, and there's a lot of seasonality, and I think Mike mentioned it earlier. If you have a high rainy spring season, you might get more wash into the system. That has as much to do with dictating the size of the dead zone in the Gulf. So a kind of a seasonal swings, annual swings in precipitation, if there's a drought year versus a wet year, that really drives sort of how the system responds. And then and whether or not you see changes in landscape scale application or ag use, those are really, multi-year lag time changes. And so my non-scientific answer is no, I would not expect COVID to have an impact on what we're seeing in the Gulf. I think, as Nancy and David explained, the surface disruption on an episodic, i.e. localized time period over a couple of weeks will impact the system down in the Gulf, but you don't see that, you don't see major changes as the agriculture shuts down for a spring. I wouldn't expect that to see a significant change, but I don't know if Mike has additional views.
Yeah, no, David, I would just support that. I think the not a scientist, so not able to confirm that piece of it. But you're definitely talking longer term change, and certainly COVID has impacted everyone, every life. But from an agriculture standpoint, no, I would not expect. There's nothing that's changed that dramatically that you would see the impact in the Gulf.
Hey, this is Dave. I would like to say just because I think it's on everyone's mind, I have been extremely proud of the Office of Water staff at EPA for, operating and keeping our programs going. Our science is progressing. Our work on our funding sources is progressing. When we went to a telework environment, I'm just really proud of the productivity of the staff. And so as far as running our water programs, the team is doing great. We're all struggling, at home and dealing with, the issues of how to deal with home life and run businesses and keep the economy going. And I can tell you from my experience, I'm just extremely proud of the Office of Water staff and our team for keeping our programs going in the face of COVID.
Okay, thank you. Operator, let's do our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Steve Davies with AgriPulse. Your line is open. Once again, Steve Davies with AgriPulse. Your line is open. Mr. Davies, if you are on mute, please unmute your line. All right, we'll move on to the next question. Our next question is from Janet McConaughey with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, would it make sense, going back to the year-round measurements, would it make sense to have a network of oxygen centers that are sensors on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico, or would that be prohibitively expensive?
This is Nancy. We used to have automated oxygen sensors in the Gulf at two stations off of eastern Louisiana, and there was another one off of western Louisiana. They are incredibly labor intensive, both with keeping the meters running and then with switching them out, which requires scuba diving and small boats, which depends on weather and things like that. It used to be part of our funding, but it's not anymore. And we got an incredibly good data set because we also had temperature, salinity, we had currents, we had waves. It was just a really good package, but it is very expensive.
Okay, let's move on. Let's do our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mark Schlesstein with New Orleans Advocate. Your line is open. Once again, Mark Schlesstein with New Orleans Advocate. Your line is open. Please remember to unmute your line. Okay.
This is Nancy. I suspect some of them are writing their stories right now.
All right. Our next question we'll take is from Steve Davies with AgriPulse. Your line is open.
Oh, okay.
Can you guys hear me?
Now we can, yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, I was unmuted before. I don't know what happened. My question is for Mike Naig. Mike, you talked about states doing a lot on nutrient reduction. Are there any states that are actually requiring nutrient reductions? Basically, what I'm talking about is the difference between voluntary measures and regulatory, and many people have said that voluntary just won't cut it. Can you speak to that, please?
You know, I can't. Thanks for the question, and I can't speak with absolute detail on every particular state. And so, again, we can certainly do some follow-up on that. And would be happy to help facilitate that. But, you know, when you look at both the non-point and the point source side of this, you've got a lot of different approaches across the states, which, of course, is, I think, as David Ross mentioned, that's a great thing about how this country works is we do have unique approaches, different approaches state to state. What I appreciate about – one of the things I appreciate about being involved in the task force is that we get a chance to interact and collaborate with each other. We love to learn from other states. We love to share what we're doing. In the state of Iowa, our nutrient reduction strategy is absolutely focused on working with landowners and working with cities and working with our wastewater and stormwater managers to do the right things. Again, not from a regulatory standpoint, but from a voluntary, although we many times say it's voluntary but not optional. And so, you know, in the state of Iowa, we're full speed ahead on implementing our nutrient reduction strategy, working with urban and rural landscapes, point and non-point. And we believe that ultimately is the best way to see the lasting change that we want to see on the landscape. Unfortunately, I can't speak to with specificity on other state approaches.
Yeah, and this is Dave. I'm happy from EPA. I'm happy to provide some of the other state perspectives. And the answer is yes, but it's a blend. So in the point source territory, there are states that are ratcheting down standards for nitrogen and phosphorus from wastewater discharge facilities. In the standard setting space, you have states that are looking at establishing numeric criteria for water bodies. Once you establish, additional standards for receiving water bodies, and that will translate through into some permitting context. You have lots of states who are, looking at, or not lots of states, you have states that are looking at developing trading programs as part of the regulatory frameworks. You have states looking at developing variances in the point source context where they can then generate fees that they can wheel money out to non-point from point sources. You also have a lot of voluntary work done in the conservation space. And so each state is a kind of an all-of-the-above strategy, and they're using the tools that work best for their particular ecology and regulatory framework. So the answer is yes, but it's also, there's a bunch of voluntary work happening as well.
Okay, operator, let's go to the next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mark Schlefstein with New Orleans Advocate. Your line is open.
Okay, trying again. Hopefully this time you can hear me. This is sort of similar to the previous question. In your press release, you're talking about the improvements that the initiatives of the task force have done. But I'm not seeing that in terms of the numbers that the U.S. Geological Survey is providing you in your in the estimates, the pre-cruise estimates of the amount of nutrients that are actually in the river, especially during high water years. Have we reached a point where not just voluntary efforts by the states is something that's going to get this reduction done? Are there efforts being made to look at more mandatory requirements for non-point source?
Well, again, this is Mike Nagy. I appreciate the question. And let's be clear here. Models are models. Estimates are estimates. Even this actual measurement is just one point in time. They're important pieces, but they don't tell the entire story. And so that's why, and again, I can, with absolute confidence, say that I know that there's more work going on in the states and up and down the river than there has been before. And certainly when I look at the state of Iowa, I know we've got more resources, more funding, more partnerships, more work being done in across the entire landscape. Again, urban, rural, point, non-point, all together. And, these nutrient reduction strategies, especially strategies that are based in science that say that when you implement X practice, it has that nutrient reduction capability, that is the best way. The only way I know how to go out and actually get the work done on the ground that ultimately improves water downstream. So I also believe, and again, I really have to just speak for our own state and our own approach at this point. But again, as David said, there's lots of approaches across the region. States will look at what works in their particular situation. But for us, we truly believe that the way to achieve the lasting change, to create a culture of conservation rather than a culture of regulation, is that we go and we work with landowners. We go and we work with cities and industries to get that work done. And we're headed in the right direction. But, and also make no mistake, we all know that there's a tremendous amount of work to do. And it is truly through committing to this over time and through years of work that we know that we can achieve the lasting change that we want. So, again, it varies from state to state. As for our state, we're focused on non-regulatory approaches.
Okay, operator, please remind our participants how to ask a question.
Yes, thank you. As a friendly reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1. And to remove your question, you may press star 2. Just a few moments for further questions.
I see one. Operator, please call on our next questioner.
Our next question is from Tegan Wendland with WWNO. Your line is open.
Hey, guys. I was just wondering if, Nancy, I know you weren't out on the cruise because of personal reasons, but if you could describe kind of how you reacted when you realized what the results were this season.
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't on the cruise because I have a fractured C2 vertebra. I'm not allowed to leave the house, let alone get on a ship. Mm-hmm. But I was there virtually for just about every station. The shifts were, 5:30 in the morning till 10 at night, and I could see the CTD traces as it went down. And after a couple of stations, it was pretty clear that most of the water column was mixed. And then I was surprised to see that there was so much, or the low oxygen that remained was so far offshore in deeper water. And then I, got the wind data and I could see why. We went ahead and mapped a lot of stations, even though we thought they would not be hypoxic because it helps the long-term data set and modeling efforts. But, I knew it didn't take long to figure out that there wasn't going to be much there. But we kept going, and it was just one of those years. And the science crew very often are excited when we see hypoxia, but the goal of the task force is not to have any anymore. So it's a mixed blessing when we have years like this.
Okay, operator, let's go to our next question.
Okay, our next question is from Nina Solana with Enders. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I understand that things like acidification and temperature change and algal blooms are increasing issues not just in the Gulf but in smaller bodies of water in the U.S., like the Great Lakes. So my question is if you could put into context this year's finding of the hypoxic zone in the Gulf, how the most recent few years, the understanding that there's a lot of variation there, compare with the trends that we're seeing in some of those smaller bodies and how might policy interplay in dealing with those different areas?
Right. These are global situations. They occur around the globe, and most of them in coastal waters are related to increased and excess nutrient loads. The Lake Erie and Chesapeake Bay would not have Chesapeake Bay actually would. There's a hurricane moving up the East Coast right now, and sometimes a hurricane can affect Chesapeake Bay, maybe not as much as the winds, but certainly with the freshwater runoff afterwards. So every place has some variability, but most of them are still closely related to the amount of nutrients that go into that water body. This is global. And the changes in the presence of low oxygen over time has been related to increased nutrient input since the 1950s, 1960s.
Yeah, and this is Dave at EPA. That's why, you're talking about a system, a very large system in the Gulf and the headwaters and the network that feeds into it. We've got a Great Lakes at EPA. We've got a Great Lakes Program Office that is spending a lot of time working with our state partners on that particular basin. And in fact, we've used new funding over the last couple of years to take kind of a new creative approach at funding some innovative work in the nutrient reduction space and trying to incentivize, market-based mechanisms to get more money flowing into the recovery. So we have strategies at, the Great Lakes Basin level, and then it goes all the way down to individual water bodies. And In my opening remarks, I mentioned, for example, we've got new draft ambient water quality criteria recommendations for nutrients in lakes and reservoirs, and it's a cool new tool that the team at EPA has developed that takes a look at a model, uses a model that tries to predict basically the stressor response. So how the ecology of a water body responds to a particular level of nutrient, given some other the other confounding variables and factors. And so it's a tool that will help states set water quality standards for individual water bodies, but using a sort of a national-based model approach that the states can then tailor. So, you know, we have different tools based on the size of the system, but they all interplay based on, at the end of the day, it's how much nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment are in the water column, and what, you know, what is the natural demand for those nutrients versus when you have excess there, and what's the ecological response. And so our tools are based on effectively addressing the level and the concentration of nitrogen and phosphorus in that water bodies.
This is Dave Kidwell from NOAA. I'll add that what we see in the Gulf of Mexico with the hypoxic zone and our ability, I mentioned the suite of forecast models that we've developed and invested in over really the last several decades to better understand the causative factors and the dynamics of the hypoxic zone, really were the leading edge of a broader initiative that we have been investing in NOAA that we call ecological forecasting, to think about it from a weather forecasting perspective, but really focused in on those ecological parameters. And so hypoxia in the northern Gulf of Mexico has been one focal area. Harmful algal blooms across the country have been another. We have some operational harmful algal bloom forecasts that are in Lake Erie, the west coast of Florida, and a number of other locations around the country. And not only do they provide us the capacity and the capability to be able to predict when and where these environmental perturbations might occur, whether it's a harmful algal bloom or a low oxygen area, but also as you build those tools, you're inherently having to build in the causative factors, whether they're natural or from nutrient inputs into the coastal systems. And so you're really developing that capacity to better understand what's happening and how you might be able to mitigate in the future through some management type actions, whether they're in the watershed with agriculture or point source production or elsewhere, to reduce the occurrence and or severity of these events into the future. And so I just wanted to mention that from a more national perspective as it relates to HABs and hypoxia, that we are investing greater into this ecological forecasting initiative and really have seen some great value in doing so across the country.
Okay, folks, we're coming up against the noon hour. Our last questioner, we have one more question. Operator, please introduce the last question.
Thank you. Our last question is from Janet McConaughey with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Going back to the matter of time and of regulatory and voluntary reductions, the people said repeatedly that it takes years and years for these changes to be seen. The task force has had about 20 years. How many more years do you think it's likely to take before any sustained change is found in the size of the dead zone?
Well, again, first of all, I would say that if that's the only metric that you're using to determine success, then I would suggest that that's not the right approach. If you want to look at a point-in-time measurement or even a model, you know, there's the estimate at the beginning of the year. You can look at those data points. That's fine to do that. They're good data points. They're interesting. They're informative. But if that's the only the way that you're going to measure success, then I would say you're missing the bigger picture. And again, I would go back to the fact that as states, and it's certainly in my role, and as I look at what other states are doing across the region, the only way that I know how to get work done and to make improvements that last the test of time is to do the work on the ground, and there is no simple solution for that. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to that. That is states being innovative. You've heard Dave Ross talk about trying to bring market drivers and dynamics into this. We're a long ways from where we want to be ultimately and where I think we can go. but there's no substitute for the hard work that has to get done on the ground. Waving a regulatory wand will not solve this issue either. So we all want easy answers, and there aren't any in this situation. So again, I would just suggest that this is one data point. This is interesting information, but you've got to look holistically. You've got to look at the work that's being done on the ground, up and down the river every day, and look at the progress that's being made there. And that's how I know that I can sit here today, this morning, and be on this call and say that we're headed in the right direction. And it will take time. And I'm not trying to be to say it's not. It will take time, but we've made good progress, and we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah, and this is Dave. I want to echo what Mike has said. There's a reason why the Epoxy Task Force set a target for 2035, recognizing that it takes time on landscape scale change. The one thing that we're focused on, and quite frankly, even in the Hypoxia Task Force, Mike and I, over the last couple of years, there have been a series of impediments for how do you take the next step. And we are reforming the Hypoxia Task Force to break down the sub-working groups to start really driving at those impediments to try to get the next generation of ideas. So even while the states implement their nutrient reduction strategies, the Hypoxia Task Force is thinking about the next step to make sure that we continue to make progress. We will watch the global trend over time, and we are confident that you will see the reductions. One of the things that we as both regulators and as, folks who deal with the Mike is the Secretary of Agriculture in Iowa, if we continue to focus only on the single endpoint and not on the successes at the local scale, you will get disinvestment and disenfranchisement of the folks and the partners that we need to help us solve this problem. And so that's why we are really focused on the Hypoxia Task Force on the local and the regional landscape scale reductions, because you get benefit at the local scale that will then improve the watershed downstream. And if you lose the partnership at the local scale, we will not get the work that we need at the global scale. And so that's why Mike and I are very focused on kind of looking for that local, measuring the local success. And if you get incremental improvement on an annual basis, you will get to the result you need at the watershed scale.
Okay, folks, it looks like that's the end of our call. I just want to remind you that an audio recording of this call will be found attached to the media advisory and the news release that we posted on NOAA.gov in about an hour and a half or so. If you have any further questions or need some follow-up, please contact me by email at Jerry, that's jerry.slaff, S as in Sam, L-A-S-F as in Frank, at NOAA.gov, or my colleague Jenny Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, at jennylyons@noaa.gov. Thanks for your participation, and thanks to all of our speakers. Stay safe, and this ends the call.
Thank you. This now concludes today's conference. All lines may disconnect at this time.